This is the University of Cambridge Local Examination Syndicate, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, November 1991 examination in English as a second language. Paper 4. Listening comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, candidate number, and center number on the front page. Don't talk to anyone during the test. If you'd like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you're doing the test. The tape should now be stopped and the papers handed out. Now you're all ready. Here's the test. Look at the questions for part one. There are 6 questions in this part of the exam. You will hear each question twice. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. Part 1, questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you'll hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You'll hear each question twice. Question 1. You're listening to the radio. Where is the Prime Minister?
It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Radio Freetown. In 5 minutes, world news. Reports from Canada on the Prime Minister's visit, plus the latest news of the week-long rail strike in Western Australia. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Radio Freetown. In 5 minutes, world news. Reports from Canada on the Prime Minister's visit, plus the latest news of the week-long rail strike in Western Australia.
Question 2. You are in a bookshop and you overhear a customer complaining. What is wrong with the book she bought?
Just take a look at this. Almost all the pages are blank. It's really awful. Just take a look at this. Almost all the pages are blank. It's really awful.
Question 3. You are about to go out and meet your friend Hassan when your mother remembers something. What does she ask you to do?
Oh, I've just remembered. Can you get that cake recipe from Hassan? His mother said she'd pass it on to me. And don't forget to return my library book on your way home. Oh, I've just remembered. Can you get that cake recipe from Hassan? His mother said she'd pass it on to me. And don't forget to return my library book on your way home.
Question 4. Your youth club leader is giving details of the next hockey match. Where should the players meet?
About our team match with Booth Hall College of Bradford Sportsfield. We meet at 10 a.m. in the gym. The bus leaves at 15:15. Don't be late. About our team match with Booth Hall College of Bradford Sportsfield. We meet at 10 a.m. in the gym. The bus leaves at 15:15. Don't be late.
Question 5. You are sitting in a library which is too hot and stuffy, and you complain to the librarian. Why is it impossible to turn the heating down?
Sorry, the caretaker says the radiator valves are stuck. We'll just have to open the windows. Sorry. The caretaker says the radiator valves are stuck. We'll just have to open the windows.
Question 6. Listen to this important announcement about your examinations. What must students bring to their exams?
This is an important announcement. There has been a major change in the organization of this year's examinations. All students are required to have their candidate number and statement of entry with them at the start of the exam. Otherwise, they will not be allowed into the examination hall. Pens and so on will be provided as usual. This is an important announcement. There has been a major change in the organization of this year's examinations. All students are required to have their candidate number and statement of entry with them at the start of the exam. Otherwise, they will not be allowed into the examination hall. Pens and so on will be provided as usual.
That is the last question in part one. In a moment, you will hear part two. Now look at part two, exercise one.
Part two. Exercise one. Question seven. Listen to this conversation at a lost property office and fill in the form. You will hear the conversation twice.
Hello. I'd like to report a lost holdall, please.
Certainly, sir. Can you give me some details, please? Your name, please.
Briggs. That's my last name. Mr. Briggs. My initials are BD.
That's B-R-I-double-G-S, is it, sir?
Yes.
Now, what about this bag? Can you give me a description?
Yes. It's a small blue nylon sports bag.
Mm-hmm. Small, you say?
Yes. It's a sort of overnight bag. You know, squarish with two zips and a carrying strap.
Can you remember what was in it?
Yes, I can. One or two items of clothing, a couple of books, and toiletries. Toothbrush, razor, that sort of thing. Nothing of any real value.
I see. So, no money?
No. But wait a minute. I bought a furry toy dog for my daughter. That was quite expensive. I'd like to get that back. It's her birthday next week. The other things don't really matter.
I see, sir. And a furry toy dog. Have you any idea when you lost the bag?
Yesterday, sometime between 12 and 1 o'clock.
Yesterday. Today's the 10th, so you lost the bag on the 9th of May.
Mm-hmm.
Whereabouts were you at the time?
I was here at the bus station in Hunter Street. I must have put it down when I was looking at the bus timetable. There was a small bench just underneath it. I must have left it there, I suppose.
Right, sir. That's all that I need for the time being. Could you estimate the value of the contents and the bag, please?
The bag cost about $30, and the contents, well, I suppose, including the toy dog, roughly $60 or $70.
Shall we say a round total of $100?
Yes, okay.
Could you give me a phone number so I can get in touch if your bag turns up? If it has been handed in, we'll let you know. There's a good chance someone handed it in, especially if there was no cash inside.
Okay, it's 335-6091. Mr. Briggs.
Right, Mr. Briggs. We'll do what we can. Goodbye.
Here is the conversation again.
Hello. I'd like to report a lost holdall, please.
Certainly, sir. Can you give me some details, please? Your name, please.
Briggs. That's my last name. Mr. Briggs. My initials are BD.
That's B-R-I-double-G-S, is it, sir?
Yes.
Now, what about this bag? Can you give me a description?
Yes. It's a small blue nylon sports bag.
Mm-hmm. Small, you say?
Yes. It's a sort of overnight bag. You know, squarish with two zips and a carrying strap.
Can you remember what was in it?
Yes, I can. One or two items of clothing, a couple of books, and toiletries. Toothbrush, razor, that sort of thing. Nothing of any real value.
I see. So, no money?
No. But wait a minute. I bought a furry toy dog for my daughter. That was quite expensive. I'd like to get that back. It's her birthday next week. The other things don't really matter.
I see, sir. And a furry toy dog. Have you any idea when you lost the bag?
Yesterday, sometime between 12 and 1 o'clock.
Yesterday. Today's the 10th, so you lost the bag on the 9th of May.
Mm-hmm.
Whereabouts were you at the time?
I was here at the bus station in Hunter Street. I must have put it down when I was looking at the bus timetable. There was a small bench just underneath it. I must have left it there, I suppose.
Right, sir. That's all that I need for the time being. Could you estimate the value of the contents and the bag, please?
The bag cost about $30, and the contents, well, I suppose, including the toy dog, roughly $60 or $70.
Shall we say a round total of $100?
Yes, okay.
Could you give me a phone number so I can get in touch if your bag turns up? If it has been handed in, we'll let you know. There's a good chance someone handed it in, especially if there was no cash inside.
Okay, it's 335-6091. Mr. Briggs.
Right, Mr. Briggs. We'll do what we can. Goodbye.
That is the end of Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2.
Exercise 2. Questions 8 to 13. Listen to this lecture to first-year computer studies students and complete the notes. You will hear the lecture twice.
Good morning and welcome. I'm Mrs. Barton. I'm your lecturer for this first term in information technology, which I hope you will all enjoy and which I'm sure you will all find fascinating. I'm also your health and safety representative, so I want to spend a few minutes talking to you about the college view on health, safety and computers. The Health and Safety at Work Act requires both employers and employees to share responsibility for safety in the workplace. So the responsibility for safe working is both yours, your colleagues, your teachers and the colleges. The widespread use of computers and VDUs, visual display units, in education, business and industry is comparatively new. This means that some of the hazards are not fully understood and long-term risks are a matter, at the moment, for conjecture. You may remember that in the past, a failure to understand the risks of X-rays and radioactive materials led to cancer and radiation sickness in experimenters. We do not expect to expose you to those kinds of risks on this course. Many of you may find that one of the commonest problems of using computers is... Yes? Can anyone guess? It's sitting still for long periods of time, keeping the hands, the head, and especially the spine in more or less one position, restricts circulation and can cause muscle strain and cramp. In severe cases, some people develop data processors disease caused by repetitive movements of fingers, and this can lead to permanent damage to muscles and tendons in the hands. Very serious indeed, but unlikely to happen to young, healthy students like yourselves.
you're more likely to suffer from the general aches and pains of sitting still for too long. The best cure for this is, of course, exercise and taking a break to relieve the tensions in the muscles. From what I see of young people, this is the least of your worries. You seem to be on the move all the time. Perhaps one of the most serious problems which could affect you is eye strain. Staring at the screen for long periods can cause eye strain, headaches, and discomfort, which may become severe. But rest assured, evidence shows that lasting eye damage is not caused by VDUs. If, however, you wear contact lenses or glasses, it's a good idea to get your eyes tested regularly, just to make sure. The college doctor can offer these tests. I'll give you the room number and so on after my talk. In general, the college tries to reduce the physical stresses of working with computers by providing good quality seating to minimize aches and pains, minimizing glare by putting an anti-glare coating on the windows of the computer rooms and giving you enough space to work comfortably. We also stress that you should take breaks if you're going to be at the screen for long periods of time. The minimum recommended break is 10 minutes per hour, and we would further recommend that you only work at the screen for between 2 and 4 hours per day. That includes work at college, and if you're lucky enough to have a computer at home, that time at home is included too. All in all, it is essential that you take regular breaks from the computer, and if you have any problems, that you see the college doctor as soon as possible. Any questions?
Now you will hear the lecture again.
Good morning and welcome. I'm Mrs. Barton. I'm your lecturer for this first term in information technology, which I hope you will all enjoy and which I'm sure you will all find fascinating. I'm also your health and safety representative, so I want to spend a few minutes talking to you about the college view on health, safety and computers. The Health and Safety at Work Act requires both employers and employees to share responsibility for safety in the workplace. So the responsibility for safe working is both yours, your colleagues, your teachers, and the colleges. The widespread use of computers and VDUs, visual display units, in education, business, and industry is comparatively new. This means that some of the hazards are not fully understood, and long-term risks are a matter, at the moment, for conjecture. You may remember that in the past, a failure to understand the risks of X-rays and radioactive materials led to cancer and radiation sickness in experimenters. We do not expect to expose you to those kinds of risks on this course. Many of you may find that one of the commonest problems of using computers is... Yes? Can anyone guess? It's sitting still for long periods of time, keeping the hands, the head, and especially the spine in more or less one position restricts circulation and can cause muscle strain and cramp. In severe cases, some people develop data processors disease caused by repetitive movements of fingers, and this can lead to permanent damage to muscles and tendons in the hands. Very serious indeed, but unlikely to happen to young, healthy students like yourselves. You're more likely to suffer from the general aches and pains of sitting still for too long. The best cure for this is, of course, exercise and taking a break to relieve the tensions in the muscles. From what I see of young people, this is the least of your worries. You seem to be on the move all the time. Perhaps one of the most serious problems which could affect you is eye strain. Staring at the screen for long periods can cause eye strain, headaches, and discomfort, which may become severe. But rest assured, evidence shows that lasting eye damage is not caused by VDUs. If, however, you wear contact lenses or glasses, it's a good idea to get your eyes tested regularly, just to make sure. The college doctor can offer these tests. I'll give you the room number and so on after my talk. In general, the college tries to reduce the physical stresses of working with computers by providing good quality seating to minimize aches and pains, minimizing glare by putting an anti-glare coating on the windows of the computer rooms and giving you enough space to work comfortably. We also stress that you should take breaks if you're going to be at the screen for long periods of time. The minimum recommended break is 10 minutes per hour, and we would further recommend that you only work at the screen for between 2 and 4 hours per day. That includes work at college, and if you're lucky enough to have a computer at home, that time at home is included too. All in all, it is essential that you take regular breaks from the computer, and if you have any problems, that you see the college doctor as soon as possible. Any questions?
That is the end of part two. In a moment, you will hear part three. Now look at the questions for part three, exercise one.
Part 3. Exercise 1. Questions 14 to 17. Listen to this extract from a radio program about raising money for charity in India. Answer the questions in the spaces provided. You will hear the extract twice.
Fundraising is always a problem for any organization, and many tend to look to the richer countries of the world, neglecting perhaps potential sources of revenue at home. Recently, the charity Help the Aged has gained some useful experience in fundraising in India. Philip Jackson told Joe Ogden how funding really can be done locally by the people themselves, and the program Help Age India is based on this idea of self-help.
Yes, for the last few years I've been involved in developing an organization in India called Help Age India. And I'm glad to say we've been able to prove that you can raise very substantial funds within India itself. You can raise funds there, and you don't need to look abroad. We've now funded over 112 major projects entirely through local donations.
Well, that's remarkable. But of course, the major question is how. How do you do this?
We have our own staff who go to schools and give a talk to the children. They don't just talk about the problems, they emphasize the contribution of elderly people to society in general. Then they talk about a local project to help old people. Maybe it's raising funds for a medical project or perhaps for a van or whatever. You describe the project to them, and then you say, how would you like to do something to help children? Hands up, all of you who'd like to help. Now that's very important, that psychological commitment by the children. A sea of hands rises up in the air. Then you explain to them how they can help. And what we usually do is organize what we call a sponsored walk. The children undertake to walk a certain distance. It's usually along a course marked out in their school compound or playing field, or in the nearby streets if the traffic is not too dangerous. And the children themselves don't give any money. They take the sponsor form to their uncles and aunties, parents and friends, who promise to pay them so much money if they complete the walk. So the whole community gets involved, and all the small individual amounts add up to a very sizable contribution. We've raised in a relatively poor school in South India the equivalent of nearly £5,500 sterling.
And as you say, the community is involved. Now, why is that so important?
Well, it's important because I think the community should A, know what sort of social work or development work is planned locally, and B, some of them may want to become more involved in the long term. Some of the people involved in the schemes we've supported in India have said afterwards, the money that has been raised through this program is marvellous, but even more valuable to us is the publicity that you've given to us within this state.
Now you will hear the extract again.
Fundraising's always a problem for any organisation, and many tend to look to the richer countries of the world, neglecting perhaps potential sources of revenue at home. Recently, the charity Help the Aged has gained some useful experience in fundraising in India. Philip Jackson told Joe Ogden how funding really can be done locally by the people themselves, and the programme Help Age India is based on this idea of self-help.
Yes, for the last few years I've been involved in developing an organisation in India called Help Age India, and I'm glad to say we've been able to prove that you can raise very substantial funds within India itself. You can raise funds there, and you don't need to look abroad. We've now funded over 112 major projects entirely through local donations.
Well, that's remarkable. But of course, the major question is how. How do you do this?
We have our own staff who go to schools and give a talk to the children. They don't just talk about the problems, they emphasise the contribution of elderly people to society in general. Then they talk about a local project to help old people. Maybe it's raising funds for a medical project, or perhaps for a van, or whatever. You describe the project to them, and then you say, how would you like to do something to help, children? Hands up, all of you who'd like to help. Now that's very important, that psychological commitment by the children. A sea of hands rises up in the air. Then you explain to them how they can help. And what we usually do is organize what we call a sponsored walk. The children undertake to walk a certain distance. It's usually along a course marked out in their school compound or playing field, or in the nearby streets if the traffic is not too dangerous. And the children themselves don't give any money. They take the sponsor form to their uncles and aunties, parents and friends, who promise to pay them so much money if they complete the walk. So the whole community gets involved, and all the small individual amounts add up to a very sizable contribution. We've raised in a relatively poor school in South India the equivalent of nearly £5,500 sterling.
And as you say, the community is involved. Now, why is that so important?
Well, it's important because I think the community should know what sort of social work or development work is planned locally, and B, some of them may want to become more involved in the long term. Some of the people involved in the schemes we've supported in India have said afterwards, the money that has been raised through this program is marvellous, but even more valuable to us is the publicity that you've given to us within this state.
That is the end of exercise one. In a moment, you will hear exercise two. Now look at the questions for exercise two.
Exercise 2. Questions 18 to 22. Listen to this extract from a radio program about a rare species of eagle. Answer the questions in the spaces provided. You will hear the extract twice.
And before we end tonight's specially extended program, bringing you the latest position on the earthquake in Turkey, we have an unusual item on attempts to save the Philippine eagle, a bird of prey, which, I have to be honest, I'd never heard of until this taped interview with our Southeast Asian correspondent, Amanda Shields, arrived on my desk. I'll let Amanda take up the story.
This is really two stories in one. First, the story of the Philippine eagle's struggle to survive, and second, the story of a truly extraordinary individual, Tom Capper, from the United States. Tom is the leader of a remarkable effort attempting, sometimes against huge odds, to save this magnificent eagle from extinction. This, you may say, is a familiar enough situation nowadays, but there are a number of factors which make this rather an unusual story. Tom Capper's love affair with birds of prey began a long time ago at home in rural America.
Yeah, I've had this feeling for birds like this ever since I was about 15, when I formed a relationship of a sort with a falcon that hung about our farmhouse one summer. We were a great team. I used to run through the fields chasing out the small animals, and he'd swoop down and help himself to his dinner. It really started quite accidentally the first time I noticed the falcon and ran off through the fields. He was up in the sky and must have spotted the way I scared some small animals out of their hiding places and spotted the opportunities for a free lunch. And that's how it really started, and how eventually I found myself involved in efforts to save this particular kind of eagle from the Philippines.
I know our listeners will be pleased to hear about any work that is trying to save endangered wildlife, but what's so special about this particular eagle? And anyway, I'd always thought that birds of that size could take care of themselves.
If only that were true. You see, the trouble with the Philippine eagle, which, by the way, is one of the largest and most magnificent of all the world's eagles, is that while other eagles, like the golden eagle, which can live in any fairly remote mountain area, or the sea eagle, which gets by catching fish, or the tawny eagle, which will eat just about anything from a spider to a buffalo, is that this eagle can only survive in very large areas of tropical forest. I don't have to tell you that that is a commodity in short supply in the world these days. I don't know if you've heard about the way they used to use canaries down mines as a sort of early warning system to detect gas. Well, that is really the way I look at the Philippine eagle. If this eagle starts to disappear, then the forest won't be far behind it, and the rest of us had better watch out.
Yes, I see what you mean. Could you tell us a little more about the project and about the support you've had from the community?
Support? Well, I don't know that I've had too much of that. Anyway, the project is really a response to the fact that miles and miles of tropical forests are being eaten up for farming and to supply the world's needs for timber. The real problem has been to persuade the local workers, and they're usually pretty poorly paid, to think again about chopping down any forest tree which has an eagle's nest in it. It's an incentive system that's as old as the hills. I just give them more money to guard the tree and the nest than they would get if they cut it down. Each person who reports a nest with an egg in it gets $50. There's another 50 when each egg hatches, and 50 again when the eaglet leaves the nest. Not a bad little earner for people who are far from well off. To be honest with you, I don't really have a lot of time for dealing with people who work in the forests. I mean, I'm not very good at getting on with people, which is why I suppose I've sort of devoted my life to animals. Give me a horse or a dog any day rather than a human being. I can get on with animals, but with people, it's not so easy for me. And of course, this has made it quite difficult for me to get the best for the eagles. The local people don't really trust me and wouldn't come near me at all if it wasn't for the money. I'd prefer it if they just weren't around, and I guess they feel the same way about me. And I don't really see that changing much. It's a real shame, because I'm sure if there was just a little more trust between us and a little less suspicion, we could work much more effectively to secure the future for these beautiful birds.
Well, thanks, Tom, for giving us this unique human angle on one of nature's endangered species.
Thank you, Amanda, who was talking to Tom Kappa in the Philippines. Next week, we have an equally interesting program.
Now you will hear the extract again.
And before we end tonight's specially extended program, bringing you the latest position on the earthquake in Turkey, we have an unusual item on attempts to save the Philippine eagle, a bird of prey, which, I have to be honest, I'd never heard of until this taped interview with our Southeast Asian correspondent, Amanda Shields, arrived on my desk. I'll let Amanda take up the story.
This is really two stories in one. First, the story of the Philippine eagle's struggle to survive, and second, the story of a truly extraordinary individual, Tom Kappa, from the United States. Tom is the leader of a remarkable effort attempting, sometimes against huge odds, to save this magnificent eagle from extinction. This, you may say, is a familiar enough situation nowadays. But there are a number of factors which make this rather an unusual story. Tom Kappa's love affair with birds of prey began a long time ago at home in rural America.
Yeah, I've had this feeling for birds like this ever since I was about 15, when I formed a relationship of a sort with a falcon that hung about our farmhouse one summer. We were a great team. I used to run through the fields chasing out the small animals, and he'd swoop down and help himself to his dinner. It really started quite accidentally the first time I noticed the falcon and ran off through the fields. He was up in the sky and must have spotted the way I scared some small animals out of their hiding places and spotted the opportunities for a free lunch. And that's how it really started, and how eventually I found myself involved in efforts to save this particular kind of eagle from the Philippines.
I know our listeners will be pleased to hear about any work that is trying to save endangered wildlife, but what's so special about this particular eagle? And anyway, I'd always thought that birds of that size could take care of themselves.
If only that were true. You see, the trouble with the Philippine eagle, which, by the way, is one of the largest and most magnificent of all the world's eagles, is that while other eagles, like the golden eagle, which can live in any fairly remote mountain area, or the sea eagle, which gets by catching fish, or the tawny eagle, which will eat just about anything from a spider to a buffalo, is that this eagle can only survive in very large areas of tropical forest. I don't have to tell you that is a commodity in short supply in the world these days. I don't know if you've heard about the way they used to use canaries down mines as a sort of early warning system to detect gas. Well, that is really the way I look at the Philippine eagle. If this eagle starts to disappear, then the forest won't be far behind it, and the rest of us had better watch out.
Yes, I see what you mean. Could you tell us a little more about the project and about the support you've had from the community?
Support? Well, I don't know that I've had too much of that. Anyway, the project is really a response to the fact that miles and miles of tropical forests are being eaten up for farming and to supply the world's needs for timber. The real problem has been to persuade the local workers, they're usually pretty poorly paid, to think again about chopping down any forest tree which has an eagle's nest in it. It's an incentive system that's as old as the hills. I just give them more money to guard the tree and the nest than they would get if they cut it down. Each person who reports a nest with an egg in it gets $50. There's another 50 when each egg hatches, and 50 again when the eaglet leaves the nest. Not a bad little earner for people who are far from well off. To be honest with you, I don't really have a lot of time for dealing with people who work in the forests. I mean, I'm not very good at getting on with people, which is why I suppose I've sort of devoted my life to animals. Give me a horse or a dog any day rather than a human being. I can get on with animals, but with people, it's not so easy for me. And of course, this has made it quite difficult for me to get the best for the eagles. The local people don't really trust me and wouldn't come near me at all if it wasn't for the money. I'd prefer it if they just weren't around, and I guess they feel the same way about me. And I don't really see that changing much. It's a real shame, because I'm sure if there was just a little more trust between us and a little less suspicion, we could work much more effectively to secure the future for these beautiful birds.
Well, thanks, Tom, for giving us this unique human angle on one of nature's endangered species.
Thank you, Amanda, who was talking to Tom Kappa in the Philippines. Next week, we have an equally interesting program.
That is the end of part three and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you've written your name, candidate number, and center number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped and all the papers collected. Thank you, everyone.